12th Army Group Headquarters. We've had a break in the weather. Today is a sleepy, warm spring day, the first we've seen in several weeks. And weather to the men who have gone through a cold winter and a cold, rainy spring is the biggest boon to their personal lives. Today is a day of relaxation. Besides that, this all comes as some kind of an anticlimax. The news of the big surrender started leaking out, being whispered around early yesterday. Then the radio news programs brought a certain amount of confirmation. So VE Day has come to this headquarters in easy stages. General Bradley was awakened in the early dawn of yesterday by a telephone call from his chief, General Eisenhower.
Brad, the chief asked.
Yes,
Bradley answered.
Well, I've put it over, Ike went on. The surrender will be effective 1 minute after midnight on Tuesday night. They talked a few minutes longer, then General Bradley started his calls to his four Army commanders. Because Patton's Third Army was advancing in an attack through Austria and Czechoslovakia, he was the first to be notified. Get word to all your units, he was told, and stop them in place. No sense in taking casualties now that it's over. And so it went on through the early morning. The news spread through this command. It was all over. By the time of our morning briefing, General Bradley was beaming, waiting to tell his correspondents the good news. At first, we understood VE Day would be celebrated tomorrow, Wednesday. The calendar over General Bradley's war maps was marked ahead to that date.
It read,
today is May 9, D plus 336. That's the way time has been reckoned over here ever since the historic D-Day, June 6, Normandy landing. May 9 carried special significance for General Bradley, for it was on that day, 1943, just 2 years ago, that he accepted his first big wholesale surrender from the Germans. It was in North Africa. The general then commanded the 2nd Corps, consisting of 5 American divisions. The surrender then was from the crack German troops making up the Africa Corps in northern Tunisia. The surrender this time was to his Führer army. Probably the nearest thing to a celebration is the assembly we have here in our press camp. Officers and men representing these four armies. Men who have had some special part in the successful operations of the past. We'll hear from some of them in a later program. But right here with me is Sergeant Joseph A. DeLisio of 1097 Longwood Avenue, Bronx, New York. He's from A Company, 27th Armored Infantry of the 9th Armored Division. One of the first men to seize and cross the Remagen Bridge across the line. Sergeant, we're certainly glad to have you with us here to help celebrate this great day. I suppose you realize you were called in here because you're part in one of the great events that helped hurry up this VE Day. Supposing you tell us about your part in it.
Well, I'm proudest of capturing the German lieutenant who was supposed to blow up the bridge. We had killed 2 of his men when I was called for the risk of the surrender. He came out saying, me engineer, bridge, boom. I also think I started that crossing by accident, or luck, or something. When Sergeant Zavick, the first one across, was asking for me,
and I was busy cleaning out 2 machine gunners from the protecting tower, my men said I had gone across. Sergeant Zavick shouted,
if Delicio's over there, he's by himself. Let's go over and help him out. He found himself the first one over, and it turned out then I had to go over and help him out.
Well, Sergeant, that was one of the big stars of the war, as you know. Now, how do you feel about this VE Day?
Well, I haven't had much time to think about it, but I'm certainly glad it's over. I can hardly believe it. It's like hearing of someone very close to you that has gotten it, has been killed. You can't believe it, and yet you have to realize that it's true. After 7 months of living in foxholes, in rain, mud, snow, and cold, and waiting for someone to come along and tell you we're going to attack again, we're jumping off and wondering if this is going to be your last time. Well, I just can't explain my feelings.
Well, I can easily believe that, Sergeant DeLisio. But it is all over, and now I hope you enjoy the rest of your stay here at this headquarters with us. It's VE Day, I'll remind you again. This is Bill Sedell at General Bradley's headquarters, and now back to CBS in New York.
From General Bradley's headquarters, we switch now to the American 9th Army front, Bill Slocum, Jr. reporting.
The tired and heroic men of the 9th United States Army put the end of this portion of their war firmly and soberly. Many a quart of cognac and many a gallon of wine went gurgling down the throats of the 9th Army Gulf Road. But these boys who became men overnight were drinking toast. Toast to the long line of graves that stretched from our rear areas to Brest and the French coast. I had the privilege of telling dozens of soldiers that the war was over. All of them grinned wryly at me and informed me that they'd heard that junk before. When I convinced them, they just laughed, shook hands among themselves, and one of them said to me, "Mister, I wish you'd told us that a year ago." Another outfit heard the news, and one of the boys hit the note that drew immediate agreement from all the rest. He said, "Gee, that's great. The folks back home will be pleased." Last night, they sat around their tents and barracks and talked it over. They talked of many things, of you at home, of those days around Bastogne. And every so often, somebody'd say, flatly and without much emotion, "Too bad Joe ain't here. He'd have got a big kick out of it." A low chorus of yours would answer, "And then we'll be back in the smell of Bastogne, or with that gal in Brooklyn or Kenosha, or drinking that whole quart of milk they all want so much." I've tried to give you a picture of the American 9th Army in this moment of triumph. It's not an easy job, because there's an awful lot of 9th Army. But if it were to be sitting in that square, it would be something like this. The 9th helped lick the jury. It did a great job, and it's proud of itself. It hopes the folks back home appreciate the job, and it hopes they're happy today. The 9th Army, wherever fame and death and loneliness has been worthwhile. This is Bill Slocum, Jr. with the 9th Army in Germany. I return you now to CBS in New York.
That was the 9th Army. Next to 3rd Army headquarters, Larry Lesser reporting.
When the ceasefire came, there was little sign of jubilation among the frontline combat troops or officers. Just a general relaxation and a change from the grim tension learned in months of combat to easy American smiles and wisecracks. They really haven't changed very much, these American soldiers. They're proving very adaptable to peace. And besides, they're a lucky one in what they call Frater Slovakia. I have just returned from Czechoslovakia, where the American Army pushed farthest to the east before the ceasefire reached them. The 4th Armored Division plunged into the land Hitler first conquered through the mile-high mountain ring of Bohemia. And the 90th Division Doughboys and the 4th Armored Spearhead yesterday met stubborn resistance from a German officer's training camp fighting in the clouds that draped the Bohemian hills. But we knew when we crossed the German Sudetenland into Bohemia, not from maps, but by the cheers of the Czech people. It was the greatest liberation greeting since we left France. They're not as volatile as the French, these dark, square-chinned Czechs with their wide-set, intelligent eyes. But they are people of great enthusiasm. They greeted us with victory arches constructed of laurel and evergreen, the signs that said, "Victory to the Americans." And the girls in native costume waited for our trunks with large trays of cakes and sandwiches. They didn't ask the Americans for cigarettes or chocolate. These proud and hospitable Czechs gave us gifts. It wasn't much. Just a few of a German cigarette. But they symbolized an appreciative, generous people. The liberated Czechs were busy wiping out the last traces of German occupation, painting over the German names given to their villages, and they were bringing in prisoners by the score. When the news of the ceasefire came, the 3rd Army was marching towards the besieged city of Prague. But as I said, all forward movement stopped. Stopped while the Prague radio was still imploring the Allies for aid. The Czechs ordered a mass rising of their army, and Czech soldiers took their uniforms out of mothballs and began to march on Prague themselves to relieve their capital from the surrounding SS troops. But at dawn this morning, the movements of the Czech patriots stopped. They learned that the SS troops had ceased fire against Prague, too. And this is Larry Lesser returning you now to New York.
We've heard now from the 3rd Army, and next we switch to Paris, Charles Collingwood reporting.
Paris victory celebrations are in full swing. They aren't yet, and they may not be very riotous and hysterical, but they're going on. They're not, for instance, as fervent and automatic as the scenes which followed the liberation of Paris, but for the first time since the liberation, there's a real sense of happiness and well-being abroad in the city. The people of Paris are physically too tired and emotionally too exhausted
to throw themselves into the wild and uproarious celebration one might have expected. Only the young people right now are really taking advantage of the situation. They're marching up and down the boulevard, singing and dancing and waving flags. They're the only ones, with the soldiers here, the American soldiers, with enough energy left to do justice to the occasion. And they make a fine and happy sight as they parade through the city making their holiday. What it'll be like tonight is hard to say, because Paris is a nighttime town. She gives her best performances by night. And when this evening the city is lit up for the first time in years, Paris may go wild. But today, most people are content just to stroll in the sunshine and feel good. There is nothing glum or unhappy about Paris today. On the contrary, it never looked more beautiful and felt more glamorous. It's just that people are so tired and so glad they want to enjoy their peace in peace. For them, as for us, the war is over. This war in Europe, anyway. And looking back on it, you think of many things. Like the first time you were seized with the awful certainty that you were going to die. And then the way you felt when you discovered that you were not, which is very much like the way one feels now. You think of London under the Blitz, when the sky itself seemed to burn, and the noise of the German bombers, and the sound of people's footsteps running. The day we hit the beaches of Normandy with the 88s coming in and the pieces of things floating in the water offshore. The way Algiers Harbor looked when we sailed in on the blue water with the city rising up white on the hills around. You remember, too, the long, cold, muddy days when nothing went right and men were killed all around and nobody got anywhere. Then there were the days of liberation with the sun shining and people crying and throwing flowers and reaching out to touch you. And sooner or later, you think of the beginning of the war and the way it was then, September 1939. Or maybe it didn't begin then. Maybe it began in Spain or in China. But for this correspondent, it began in London in September 1939. We didn't know what war was then. You could buy anything you wanted in the stores. Your job wasn't any different than what it was before. Except for those who went into the army, it was just that someone had said there was a war. Everyone thought they could imagine then what it would be like. When the first false air raid sounded in London, everyone crowded into the shelters and had hysterical wardens shouting in their ears to put that cigarette out. Do you want us all to get killed? And then now, there's that final scene in the math room of the school building supreme headquarters in Reims. I stood in the back and watched the German plenipotentiary, Colonel General Jodl, sign the paper that meant it was all over. There they sat around the battered old table that you wouldn't have in your kitchen. And what they were doing was ending it all. In itself, it wasn't a very impressive scene. No fanfares, no production. Everyone did their best to act in a matter-of-fact way. It wasn't the scene itself that made you hold your breath. It was the occasion. It was what it meant. It was the sense that this was the end which sent your mind racing back across all those years that seemed like months and those months that seemed like years, back to when it began and then through again all the things that had happened. We've come a long way since then. We've learned what war is. We've learned what it takes and how to fight it. We Americans had more to learn and learned it faster than anyone else. When we came to North Africa, our first overseas campaign in the West, we were an army of rank amateurs. We didn't know the first thing about war. It almost seemed as though we didn't want to learn. We learned, though. And in learning, we changed the whole character of modern war. It was a completely different kind of war when it ended than it was when it began. And it was American ideas and techniques as much as anything that changed it. But the war taught us other things as well as the soldiers' trade. Things that it would be well to remember. It taught us, first of all, that we couldn't do it alone. That we couldn't separate our effort from the rest. It taught us, too, that an alliance, a partnership of nations, can work. Nations can work together as long as both sides want to enough. And perhaps, most of all, the war taught us, or should have taught us, that you can't buy out of unpleasant things with money or production or inventions or anything. The only response to the basic problems which confront our nation can be faith and sacrifice and cooperation. We have to meet our problems honestly and do what must be done. If the war has taught us that, it has not been in vain. This is Charles Collingwood in Paris, returning you to the Columbia Broadcasting System in New York.
Columbia's correspondents have reported from the 9th and 3rd Armies, from General Bradley's headquarters, and from Paris. Now the Pacific. We switch to CBS Manila, William J. Dunn reporting.
This is Columbia in San Francisco calling Manila. We're sorry, but we seem unable to contact the Philippines this morning. Now back to CBS World News in New York.
Back again in New York. We'll try our correspondents in the Pacific a little later in this program. Perhaps I don't think I've had time yet to tell you that a communique issued by the German High Command this morning and broadcast over that radio station identifying itself as Flensburg announced that henceforth the greeting Heil Hitler will be banned within the German armed forces. Prime Minister Winston Churchill, a few minutes after broadcasting his Victory Day in Europe pronouncement, which we carried over this network, went to a madly cheering House of Commons in London to repeat his epic-making declaration that the arms and might of Germany have bowed to the overpowering strength of the United Nations. He was smiling broadly as he arose to deliver his victory speech. As he appeared from behind the speaker's chair, the whole house rose. Members cheered loudly, and they waved their order papers, while those in the side galleries and the strangers' gallery got to their feet and joined in the thunderous applause. There was another great roar of cheers when the Prime Minister rose and said he thought it might be convenient if he repeated the official statement he had just made on the radio, and then he repeated in full his broadcast announcement. Lord Wilton, the Minister of Reconstruction, read the statement in the House of Lords, which Prime Minister Churchill was making at the same time in the House of Commons, and then the House of Lords adjourned to attend divine service. A deafening cheer greeted the end of Mr. Churchill's message to the nation when he said, in that resounding voice, "Advance, Britannia, long live the cause of freedom, God save the King." And then Mr. Churchill expressed his gratitude to the House, which has proved itself, he said, the strongest foundation for waging war that has ever been seen in the whole of our long history. We have all made our mistakes, but the strength of parliamentary institutions has been shown. And now we are going to try another of our correspondents in the Pacific, so we switch now to Admiral Nimitz's Advanced Fleet Headquarters on Guam, Gene Ryder reporting.
Eisenhower is flying by Fleet Admiral Nimitz, Commander-in-Chief Pacific Fleet and Pacific Ocean Areas. The smashing victory of American and Allied arms over Germany ends a reign of brute force and terror in Europe. Millions of the world's people are beholden to you and the superb forces under your command for the restoration of their right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The victory confirms the wisdom of our world strategy, which required the use of the bulk of our strength against Germany while holding Japan and driving them back wherever possible. Now the whole overwhelming weight of our force can be turned upon our treacherous enemy in the Pacific. Japan deserves, and from now on will receive, our united and undivided attention. My sincere congratulations to you, your staff, and all the men of your command on the completion of a formidable task supremely well done. That's the way Admiral Nimitz says it, and I'm sure that if all the anonymous men of every rank who faced the Japanese in the Pacific could send a message to the anonymous men of the Allied armies who fought the Germans all over Europe, it would be termed exactly as Admiral Nimitz expressed himself. There's far more reaction here this 1 a.m. than there was last night. The official announcement of victory in Europe had been expected all day, and most everyone has waited up tonight to hear from our world leaders. The armed forces radio stations, usually signed off by 10 p.m., are on the air now, rebroadcasting shortwave programs from stateside, and every radio has a large audience. There aren't any organized celebrations, just little groups of men around radio sets listening to short-waved words coming from half a world away. Speaking from somewhere in the Pacific for the 3rd Marine Division, General Graves B. Erskine, who took his Marines into the center of the Iwo battle to roll back the Japanese, says, "The victory of our mighty forces over Germany was a masterful accomplishment which commands the admiration of every Marine. To the valiant men in Europe, the 3rd Marine Division sends a salute. We've already hit the Japs hard, and we pledge that we will not relax for an instant while the forces in Europe are being moved to the Pacific Theater. But the quicker this is accomplished, the quicker the final knockout blow can be administered. The feelings out here tonight are a mixture of admiration for the job done in Europe and an eagerness to be on to total victory with the full might of America and our allies concentrated on one front. This is Gene Ryder at Guam. I switch you now to Tim LeMert at Okinawa.
This is Tim LeMert off the coast of Okinawa. It has been about 24 hours now since the first word of the German unconditional surrender was received here in Okinawa. Because the initial announcement came in the middle of the night, many of the men on shore and aboard the ship didn't hear of it for several hours. This morning, the news passed over ship public address systems and from command post to command post, from foxhole to muddy foxhole. There were a few shouts, few displays of emotion. To many, it was just another day of fighting against the fanatical Japs. What many were openly feeling around the world, the fighting man here realized for the most part within himself. All knew it was in his fourth way, a day that would be remembered for generations to come. They also knew that it was a step toward the end of their war against Japan. Just how much of a step would remain to be seen. For a sailor, soldier, or marine flattening himself against the ground in front of the battle-burned fortifications in which the Japs hung on tenaciously, there was little time to do much thinking. He was too busy ducking the mortar and the artillery shell. It has been a cold, miserable day on Okinawa. The rain has been pouring down, turning everything into a quagmire of the stickiest mud imaginable. In this slop, the Japs are gradually being pushed back from their well-constructed entrenchments. It is hardly a setting for tremendous rejoicing. But the single effect of drilling and surrender has raced across the island. As the day grew into evening, small discussions went on among the men. Corporal Ross Pinkstaff of Robinson, Illinois, told me how the news had been received at the front lines with the Marines. At first, they thought it was just another rumor, he said. But then they realized that it was the truth. No, there was no yelling, but most of us were pretty happy. Seaman First Class George Durant of Pittsburgh, he asked a brother on the other side, said that he thought that many of the troops over there deserved a rest. He thinks that they will be sent home, and some of the men in the States that have yet to go overseas will be sent out here. Those who will be sent directly to the Pacific will probably have to be given different training for the war against the Japs. However, he concluded, it's mighty good news. Mighty good. Then there was the sailor who exclaimed to me, I can just see my dad today. He'll have to take all those pins out of that map of his. Thus was the news received here on Okinawa. The news has changed nothing in the actual fighting. Tonight again, the Jap suicide planes may be over to keep all of us awake as they try desperately to dive into our ship. Tonight, the Japs may attempt an counterattack. All know that the final victory day is far closer. But they say to those of you at home, almost to a man, have your celebrations, but don't forget that there is still another victory day we have yet to celebrate. This is Tim LeMert off the coast of Okinawa. I return you now to the United States.
While our correspondents have been telling us firsthand about the reaction to VE Day around the world, we've been getting news of reaction from other points here at our Columbia News headquarters in New York. Copenhagen residents, for example, are weary after 3 days of celebrating their own liberation, but just the same crowds throng the streets in the Danish capital, parading and cheering the Allies with voices that are noticeably hoarse from thousands of hurrahs and much non-stop singing. In Rome, the reaction is both gay and sober. The Allied troops who knew that they had fought and won are whooping it up hilariously, but Italian citizens who know that their nation had been on the wrong side are gravely pondering the future. That's the news that we get from Rome. Australia is taking the news of VE Day very quietly. A public holiday has been proclaimed for tomorrow in Australia, and Thanksgiving services will be held in all states. Big services will be held in most public squares. The news is still coming in very rapidly now that the official day of victory has been proclaimed by President Truman and by Prime Minister Churchill at 9 o'clock in the morning New York time, in other words, just about 2 hours ago, and we have still not heard from Marshal Stalin, but as Prime Minister Churchill told us, The ceremony will be held later in the day in Berlin, at which the surrender document will be signed again and will be ratified, and it would be natural to expect that at that hour, the Moscow radio will come on with the news that this is VE Day in Russia as well. We just have news from London, as a matter of fact, that informed circles in London are paying particular attention to the passage in Mr. Churchill's victory message, in which he said that tomorrow we shall pay a particular tribute to our Russian allies. And these circles in London are interpreting this statement to mean that the Russians will celebrate VE Day tomorrow after the surrender agreements have been signed, sealed, and delivered. That's the news from London. However that may be, as we told you earlier, Columbia's shortwave listening station reports that the Moscow radio has been behaving oddly. As a matter of fact, the shortwave transmitters, the Moscow transmitters, which can be heard here in the United States, went off the air at 9 o'clock, at the hour at which we were rather expecting Marshal Stalin to speak. And some 20 minutes later, they came on again without saying whether he had spoken or not, and they began to broadcast very routine communiques from Yugoslavia and from Romania, and also they began to broadcast in the Turkish language and other broadcasts that are strictly routine. So we don't really know what Moscow is going to do. It seems likely that the celebration will come after the Berlin ceremony, and whether the celebration in Russia will actually come later today or will not come until tomorrow, we just can't tell. Word from Ottawa that most Canadians today regarded VE Day as the end of the war with them, with the plans for carrying on the struggle against Japan mostly involving civilian effort. Labor Minister Mitchell announced that call-ups for military service under the National Resources Mobilization Act were suspended, but that enrollment of volunteers for the Pacific War had been made. And now we're going to have another switch to one of our correspondents abroad. We take you now to Lüneburg, Germany. Bill Downs reporting.
This is Bill Downs speaking from Lüneburg. This V-Day has started out very quietly here in Lüneburg on the British sector. The convoys continue to roar through the narrow streets and the long, long lines of surrendering Germans and liberated Allied war prisoners and slave laborers stream back to the rear areas. The people of Lüneburg are going about their business as this was just another day. It may be V-Day for the Allies, but it's Surrender Day for the Germans. The people I saw this morning look like they're trying to ignore the whole thing. The shops are opening up, and already the long lines at the food stores are collecting. Ex-Nazi Hausfrauen, with their baskets and string bags, beginning a life of queuing that has plagued all of Europe since the Nazis went on the warpath. It's a beautiful day here. The weatherman could not have planned more perfect weather for a surrender celebration. But right now, there's very little celebrating. The British are reserved people, and out of propriety for the French and American and Russian forces still fighting, they did no dancing in the streets when Montgomery signed the surrender terms that put the British 2nd and the Canadian 1st Armies out of the war last Thursday. But no doubt tonight, the bottles of French champagne, which we find in every rich German's wine cellar, will make their appearance. But meanwhile, the army is too busy to celebrate victory in Europe Day. The millions of German soldiers must be kept moving to the concentration areas. The liberated Allied prisoners must be evacuated, and somehow the slave laborers who look to us for help must be housed and fed. But I have an idea that tonight there will be a hot time in Lüneburg. This is Bill Downs with the British, returning you to CBS in New York.
Back again at Columbia's news headquarters in New York. I might take this opportunity just 40 seconds before we pause for station identification to remind our listeners that we are continuing our Victory Day broadcasts throughout the morning, and from time to time we are able to tell you just what we are planning as the moments go on. As a matter of fact, in just exactly 50 seconds from now, at 11 a.m. Eastern Wartime, Columbia will bring you another broadcast from the European Theater of Operations, during which we'll hear from the Army commanders who led the Allies to victory in Europe. And we'll hear from such generals as Patton, Simpson, Hodges, and Patch, and other generals. And now we do pause. This is Bob Trout speaking. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
CBS World News Headquarters in New York. Continuing Columbia's VE Day programs, we present now the second in a series of broadcasts in which we're to hear from the men who led our armies to victory in Europe. During the next 25 minutes, the commanding generals of 6 United States armies in Western Europe and the commander of Canadian troops will speak to those of us observing VE Day here in the United States and to the men and women of the armed forces. We take you now to Supreme Allied Headquarters in Paris.
This is the European Theater of Operations. You're about to hear personal messages from the commanding generals of the Allied armies which have fought their way to final victory on the Western Front. First, General George S. Patton, who commanded the 2nd Armored Corps in Africa and the 7th Army in Sicily before assuming the leadership of the United States 3rd Army in its historic advances across France and Germany. General Patton.
Now that victory in Europe has been achieved, let us review the 3rd Army's part in this epic struggle. From Avalanche to Brest, thence across France, Germany, and into Austria, the 3rd Army and its equally victorious comrades of the 19th Tactical Air Command have fought their way. The Seine, the Loire, the Moselle, the Saar, the Rhine, and the Danube, not to mention 20 other lesser rivers, have been successfully stormed. The Siegfried Line has been penetrated at will. Metz, Trier, Koblenz, and Frankfurt, and countless other cities and towns have been cleared of the enemy. More than 80,000 square miles of country have been liberated or conquered. You have demonstrated your irresistible prowess in France, Belgium, Luxembourg, Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Austria. You have captured more than 750,000 Nazi soldiers and have killed or wounded at least 500,000 others. But in thinking of the heritage of glory you have achieved, do not be unmindful of the price you have paid. Throughout your victorious advances, your line of march is marked with the graves of your heroic dead, while the hospitals are crowded with your wounded. Nor should we forget the effort of those at home, who have invariably provided us with the sinews of war, the means to victory. To those at home, we promise that with their unremitting assistance, we shall continue, so that with the help of Almighty God and through the inspired leadership of our President and the High Command, we shall conquer not only Germany, but also Japan, until the last danger to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness shall perish from the earth.
Thank you, General Patton. From the time of the Saint-Lô breakthrough to the capture of Leipzig and its link up with the Russians on the Elbe, the United States 1st Army has been commanded by General Courtney H. Hodges. General Hodges.
With victory in Europe an accomplished fact, it is fitting that we of the 1st United States Army should pause to review our accomplishments and to pay tribute to those who gave their lives and to those who lie wounded, that our army might move relentlessly forward. I wish they all could know we haven't forgotten that they too are part of this great 1st United States Army and a part of this hard-won victory. From the beaches of Normandy to the heart of Germany has been a long, difficult struggle, but we can rest secure in the knowledge of a job well done. Speaking now to the men of the 1st Army, America will long remember D-Day in Normandy and the bitter fighting that followed as you expanded your bridgeheads and liberated the Cherbourg Peninsula, and then the long summer days of hedgerow fighting as you moved into position for the breakthrough at Saint-Lô. Sweeping through France and Belgium, you paused only to annihilate the German counterattack at Mortain, encircle large numbers of the enemy at Argentan and Elbeuf, and again at Mons. In your 450-mile dash from Saint-Lô to the Siegfried Line, you liberated vast areas of northern France and Belgium. You were the first to crack the Siegfried Line, and during the Ardennes campaign, you held the best troops the Germans could concentrate. You recoiled from the blow to drive the Nazis back across the banks of the Rhine. It was First Army that seized the first bridgehead at Remagen. With skill and audacity, you breached the last Nazi obstacle on the road to Berlin. Your drive toward Berlin is history now, with its total of nearly 900,000 prisoners captured since D-Day. After crossing the Rhine at Remagen, you drove relentlessly east and north, exploiting your breakthrough and linking up with the Ninth Army to close the Ruhr pocket on over 324,000 Germans. From Kassel, you fought on two fronts separated by over 200 miles. On the west, you mopped up the pocket, and to the east, you advanced swiftly to the Elbe. It was you who first contacted our gallant Soviet allies at Torgau, a fitting climax to a long line of firsts for the first U.S. Army. On this day of victory in Europe, you should feel proud. Proud of the fight you have made. Proud of the tremendous work on the home front. Proud of our allies and proud of our cause. Millions of mothers and fathers in America have contributed courage, sacrifice, and superb fighting men to this victory. However, our fight is not yet over. We still have one more of the aggressor nations to defeat. I have every confidence in the final victory. Hard work, hard fighting, and a great sacrifices are still ahead on the home and the fighting fronts. And not until Victory Day in the Pacific can we lay aside our weapons and resume life in a free world.
Thank you, General Hodges. Lieutenant General Lewis H. Brereton has commanded the 1st Allied Airborne Army from the time of its formation prior to the airborne invasion of Holland. Since then, he has directed the airborne crossing of the Rhine and all the supply and evacuation operations of the Troop Carrier Command. General Brereton.
For the soldiers of the 1st Allied Airborne Army, this is a long-awaited day. Germany is a ruined and hopeless country. The German soldier is stripped and stands defeated in his own ruins. Our airborne soldiers have used the fullest power and speed of modern war. They have never failed to gain their objectives. We give them our deepest thanks now and forever. Our airborne army is an allied fighting force. It represents millions of British, American, Polish, and French families. You may all have the greatest personal pride in your sons and brothers and fathers. They have served you well and faithfully. In Africa, Sicily, and Normandy, in southern France and Holland, in the raw days of the battle in the Ardennes salient, and finally in the epic crossing of the Rhine. I thank and congratulate the British and American airmen who have made possible our successful operations. We owe the same gratitude to the magnificent ground troops. General Frederick Browning and General Richard Gale, as successive deputy commanders of this Allied Airborne Army and as commanders of the British First Corps Airborne, have given unsparingly. I am deeply thankful to the outstanding British officers and men of my headquarters. I cannot adequately express my admiration for the gallant leadership of General Roy Urquhart, commanding the British 1st Airborne Division, and General E.L. Bolt of the British 6th Airborne Division. I take pride in the achievements of the 17th Airborne Division under Major General William Miley, the 82nd Airborne Division under Major General James Gavin, and the 101st Airborne Division under Major General Maxwell Taylor. These divisions, comprising the 18th Corps Airborne under Major General Matt Ridgway, have formed one of the world's finest fighting teams. This was not an easy reputation to win. The German was a dangerous and determined ground fighter. Troop carrier units of 38 and 46 groups, Royal Air Force, under the command of Air Vice Marshal Scarlett Stratfield, and the United States 9th Troop Carrier Command under Major General Paul L. Williams, made a glorious battle record for themselves. Besides their hazardous combat role, these vulnerable carrier planes became flying gas lines and ammunition carriers for our swiftly advancing armored forces. They furnished our columns with as much as 1 million gallons of gasoline a day on the front lines. Since the invasion, the Troop Carrier Command has evacuated more than 300,000 wounded soldiers. We have ahead of us a hard and bitter campaign against the Japanese. The same invincible fighting spirit displayed in Europe will be carried to the Pacific and will hasten a day of victory in the Pacific War.
Thank you, General Brereton. Lieutenant General William H. Simpson has commanded the United States 9th Army from Brittany through Belgium, across the Ruhr and the Rhine during the Battle of the Ruhr and on into Germany. General Simpson.
Today, on this day of worldwide celebration and of thanksgiving to the Almighty God who has blessed us with victory over Germany, I'm happy and proud to render to the American people the accounting of their 9th United States Army. It has been a great pleasure and a greater honor to command the 9th Army, for it has a distinguished record brought about by the outstanding characteristics of leadership, resourcefulness, daring, enthusiasm, and courage of the American soldier. From the days of our first action in the British Brittany Peninsula of France to the final defeat of the German Wehrmacht, all our operations have been characterized by intelligent planning and preparation, brilliant and daring execution, and inevitable victory. The 9th U.S. Army first took its place alongside of the other great American and Allied armies on September 5th, 1944, when it was given the mission of reducing the fortress Brest in western France. That mission was accomplished in 14 days. The 9th U.S. Army then moved east and joined the other armies facing Germany on October 2nd, 1944, when we took up positions between the 1st and 3rd Armies along the Siegfried Line from Luxembourg City to St. Vith, Belgium. Here we remained on an active defensive role, probing the enemy lines for weak spots and building up supplies to carry us on deeper into Germany. The period from November 28, 1944 to February 23, 1945 found the 9th Army resting on the banks of the swollen and potentially dangerous Ruhr River. It was during this period that the ill-fated German counteroffensive in the Ardennes Forest was met and defeated. Many troops had to be dispatched from the 9th Army front to the Ardennes, and in a large measure they contributed to the crushing German defeat. It was also during this period that the 9th Army came under the command of Field Marshal Montgomery's 21st Army Group. During the time that we served under this able commander, it again became evident that nothing but the closest cooperation and deepest admiration existed between American and British forces. The final drive to victory was begun on February 23, 1945, when the powerful 9th Army crashed out of its Ruhr River positions, won its bridgehead, and turned northeast towards the Rhine River and the industrial area of the Ruhr Valley. In just 8 days, the 9th Army moved from the Ruhr to the Rhine, covering 75 miles and capturing nearly 30,000 prisoners. Pausing only long enough to regroup forces and build up supplies, the 9th Army again struck at the German armies when on March 24th we crossed the Rhine River. In 19 days, we had advanced 225 miles and secured a bridgehead over the Elbe River, 65 miles short of Berlin. The end you know. Germany has been defeated, and the 9th Army has played an important role in contributing to that defeat. To the men of the 9th Army, I again extend my sincerest congratulations and thanks for a job that has been well done and which, in truth, was in keeping with the highest traditions of the military service. To the American people, I say that even though victory has been won in Europe, we will not rest until Japan has been defeated, and should the 9th Army be ordered into action in the Pacific theater, that we are ready to carry on and help bring a final and lasting peace to the world.
Thank you, General Simpson. On the far northern flank of all Allied operations in France, in Belgium, in Holland, and in Germany, the 1st Canadian Army has driven to its objectives in spite of heavy opposition and difficult terrain. Here is its commander, General H.D.G. Crerar, with his VE Day message to the United States and to our Canadian allies across the border. General Crerar.
Victory Day, at long last, has arrived. The business we Canadians came over here to do is virtually finished. There will yet be quite a lot of tidying up to complete. But the military might of Hitler's Germany is a horror of the past. The world, definitely, has been delivered from domination by Hitler and his pack of gangsters. And in this prolonged and bitter struggle, now crowned with victory, the Army of Canada has played a sterling part. Canadians are entitled to be very proud of their soldiers. I am certainly, called beyond words to count myself one of them. It has been a great inspiration and a great challenge to one's own capacities to be a commander of such men. I have never met a Canadian commanding officer who has regarded his responsibilities otherwise. The very best that one has been able to give them has never been as complete as one would have wished. Yet, that compelling urge to be fully worthy of those responsibilities has shown itself during all our operations in the outstanding conduct of Canadian commanders, senior and junior, brigadier and lieutenant colonel, sergeant and corporal. They have led their men in battle. They have never spared themselves. Also, they have paid the full price, knowing beforehand that whatever it might be, it would be worth the payment. We have reached the time when the great and gallant company which has formed the First Canadian Army is about to dissolve. By groups and by units, with anticipation and joy in their hearts, tempered by the memories of the friends they have lost, the Canadians who have survived will be returning home to Canada. I believe that the future of Canada rests in their hands. It will be a grand future should they be given the opportunity, in peace, to prove and practice the admirable characteristics they have demonstrated in war.
Thank you, General Crerar. Lieutenant General Alexander M. Patch, a veteran of operations on Guadalcanal and in New Caledonia, assumed command of the United States 7th Army in Italy and led his troops during the invasion of southern France and on into Germany. General Patch.
As we rejoice together over the accomplished fact of victory in Europe, it is fitting that we pause a moment to consider the fallen thousands who have laid down their lives to bring about this triumphant day. They gave up all they had. Let us hope that the peace to come will justify their sacrifice. For the survivors, what spoken message could express the deep sense of thanksgiving and satisfaction which all of us must feel who have had some part, however small, in this titanic campaign now crowned with victory. You men of the 7th Army have pursued the Germans through Africa, Sicily, Italy, France, and finally to this inner stronghold. Some of you came over the beaches of Normandy to join your brothers in arms from the south. The sun has not always shone upon you. Indeed, there have been bitter moments, but you have bravely persevered, and you have won. The courage and the ability of the American citizen, under arms, needed no proof. You have been true to his most glorious tradition. Challenged by the Nazi braggart, you dropped your peaceful pursuits and beat him magnificently at his own bloody game. You have met him with the weapons of his own choosing, and you have laid him low, finally and completely. I congratulate you and commend you to the American people as worthy of their highest gratitude. Our triumph would be complete were it not for our realization at this moment of well-earned rejoicing that the world's struggle is not yet won. In the Pacific, Americans and their allies are still locked in combat with Japan. It may be a long time before the evil aggressor of Pearl Harbor has been forced back to his dragon's lair and slain for good. Until that day, real peace for Americans will not be possible. The struggle in the Far East permits no relaxation of our nation's effort, military, naval, or civilian. In this regard, the men of the 7th Army, and I say this with the utmost confidence, will know their duty.
Thank you, General Patch. Lieutenant General Leonard T. Giroux commanded the 29th Division before D-Day, the 5th Corps of the 1st Army during the invasion and the Battle of Normandy, and afterwards became the commanding general of the United States 15th Army. General Giroux.
In 1942, the decision was made to forge a steel ring of Allied bayonets around the boundaries of the Nazi slave empire, and then to contract that ring until the military might of Germany was strangled. With the landing of the Allied forces in Normandy, the segments of the ring were complete. Now only remained the task of tightening the band to complete the first phase of the obliteration of Nazism, the destruction of the German military machine. Today we thank God that this first phase has been accomplished, and that the German Army, Navy, and Air Force are no longer a menace to the world. We are justly proud of this victory, made possible by the skill, heroism, and unselfishness of the American soldier, both men and women, and their comrades in the armies of our allies. In our day of triumph, we pause and pay tribute to those who gave their lives that liberty might live. The 15th Army, which I have the honor to command, is a new army. It assumed an operational role too late to play a major part in the destruction of the German armies. It is made up, however, of men who fought gallantly with other armies early in the war. Serving with me are veterans of Africa, Italy, the Normandy beaches, and the battlefields of France, Belgium, and Luxembourg. They knew the bloody battle of Hecken Forest, the bleak winter in the Siegfried Line, and the desperate Ardennes struggle when Hitler made what we now know was Germany's last effort to win. I am proud of their accomplishments. To these veterans and to the newer soldiers who were not with us only because they were called up later, I say congratulations on a job well done, but only half finished. There are still uncompleted tasks ahead. German military power has been destroyed, but Nazism remains to be stamped out. For some of us, there's a job of occupation to be done, Nazi criminals to be brought to justice, an enemy population to be retrained for future life in a civilized world. For others, there will be new battlefields in the Pacific area. We are justified in pausing briefly today in recognition of our victory, but we must pause only and not stop. Japan, the arch criminal of the East, is still oppressing and enslaving peace-loving people, still torturing our prisoners, and still attempting to destroy the freedom for which we stand. Ahead of us lies the grim necessity of completing the overthrow of this remaining enemy, an enemy fully as ruthless and treacherous as the foe we have just conquered. We hope the job will not take long. The qualities of our fighting men, the all-out support of a united home front, and an abiding faith in God have brought us far. We must not stop now. The day of rest will come when Nazism has been stamped out and Japan meets the same fate as Germany. Then, and only then, can we say well done to a finished task and resume our normal lives in a safe and peaceful world.
Thank you, General Giroux. From the European Theater of Operations, we return you to the United States.
During the past 25 minutes in this broadcast from headquarters, we've heard from Generals Patton, Simpson, Brereton, Hodges, Patch, and Giraud, who command the American armies in Western Europe, and from General Crerar, the commander of the Canadian First Army. In just a moment, CBS correspondents attending the San Francisco conference will report the VE Day reaction there. And our reporters overseas will be heard from the fighting fronts where the war against Japan goes on with utmost determination despite the end of hostilities in Europe. At 12:15 Eastern Wartime, CBS World News will take its microphones into large cities and small towns from coast to coast to hear how the average citizen here at home is reacting to VE Day. And at 1 o'clock Eastern Wartime, in a special five-star program, we will hear from Generals Marshall, Eisenhower, MacArthur, and Arnold, and from Admirals King, Leahy, and Nimitz. This broadcast has come to you from CBS World News. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.